Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care. Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara.
Today is a very special episode. My husband's joining us.
Yeah.
Dear God.
Okay, so in all fairness, I only know the colloquial version of the Honorable Michael Rourke. I don't know the original version. And so it was pretty fun to talk with him, and I was pleasantly surprised. That's probably, he's going to listen to this and he's going to have something to say because that's his thing. But he's going to be like, what the hell, Kara? I was like, oh, it's kind of like when we listen to ourselves and we're like, we're good at this? And I was like, he's good at this? What?
I can't say this to him or in front of him because his head will get bigger than it already is, but Mike is legitimately an expert in his field. He has been doing this for his entire career, and he is looked to nationwide as one of the leading experts as a trial lawyer. So
he has many, 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 many years of experience. Many years of experience at this.
He's going to fly across the country just to piss in your Cheerios.
That's fine.
It's fine. Cheerios. We're really excited to bring you this episode today. Also, because right now I am currently in Chicago presenting at the In Violence Against Women International Annual Conference alongside Michael. And where are you, Kara?
I am getting ready to go to a training for a podcast network, and it's on ethics in true crime podcasting. So, you know, taking those baby steps, changing the world, one keynote at a time.
I love it, though. This is a great week because we're both out doing the things that we love to do most. It's re-energizing. We're bringing you this episode, and we think it's going to be really great. It's so funny to listen back to this because it's my husband and his voice, and it's him in work mode, I guess. You all know that this is how I first met him, and so that's the only version of Michael that I knew for so very long. But for Kara to be able to experience this, too, was really fun.
Yeah, I think Joe's going to enjoy listening to it, too. Coming from military and law enforcement background, in which your mentality can get very skewed and you can get very jaded, he is really being intentional about learning what it means to be supportive and be victim-centric. And it is a shift in his approach and his mentality from what is a very toxic masculinity culture to a supportive culture. And he's always been great, very supportive of me, but I'm watching him think about the decisions that he is making and the things that he says and being more intentional about it. So it will probably be a good conversation for men to listen to understand how to walk that line of being a strong alpha male and also being supportive of survivors and victims and victim-centric. Mike does a very good job of being a role model for those things.
Yep. You'll hear both of us talk about there is still work to be done, but the leaps and bounds that he has taken just in addressing his own mental health, that of his office, and for prosecutors in general is really impactful. And I forget that sometimes because we go to bed together and we're in the thick of parenting and everything else here. Ew. But I forget that sometimes that what he is doing is not the norm. We've heard stories about prosecutors or district attorney's offices or law enforcement maybe not handling cases in the best way. And I forget that that happens sometimes because Mike does such an above and beyond job at his office. I don't want to gush too much or take away from the episode here, but I loved having him on. And if you're not part of our Patreon yet, you should join because that will be where we had a ton more content from this episode that we're going to put over there in video form. But we're going to skip doing Michael's bio today because he needs to update his bio, but also he goes into his background and his career. So he is currently the Weld County District Attorney that is in an elected position here in Colorado. But for today, enjoy this conversation with my husband, Michael.
Enjoy the conversation with the Honorable Michael Rourke.
Gah.
That's his official title. He must be called that henceforth.
Ridiculous.
The Honorable Michael Rourke.
Ridiculous.
Take it away, Kim.
Absolutely not.
All right. We have a very, very special guest today, the Honorable Michael J. Rourke, Kim's significant other half.
Oh, my God.
Isn't it the better half?
No. Okay. Thank you for making the long commute all the way to our office here.
All the way from the couch?
Yes. Yeah. We have been talking about having this episode for quite some time, much to Michael's chagrin. And while he is an expert in the field, I also am going to relentlessly make fun of him. So be ready for that. I think you're cute.
I'm looking forward to it.
He will definitely give it back, though. So
yes. Well, Mike, we do an icebreaker every time. And I know the answer to this, but tell us about what you are currently binge watching, reading, listening to.
What are you talking about?
What
am I binge watching?
Okay. We should also note the generational difference here. From the get-go. What did we last binge watch?
Yellowstone.
Okay. Yellowstone. And 1923.
And 1923 and 1883. All the things Yellowstone. It's fantastic.
And we just started 1899. Have you seen this?
No, but you have to like pay attention, right? Like you have
a lot.
Okay. Yeah. Because I was like, oh, I'll watch this while I do something else. And I quickly realized I can't do that. Yeah.
No, I can't even like doom scroll. Like you have to be watching it, and you're not supposed to watch it with the English dubbed version. You're supposed to watch it with like actual subtitles. So it's a setting that you have to change. Otherwise the mouths don't like line. It was bizarre. But yeah. I mean, I'm kind of getting into it because I am a little bit of a sci-fi nerd. I don't mind it.
I fell asleep in the last episode last night. So I'm out.
I might be watching this one on my own from here on out.
It's all you.
Okay. To your comfort level, Michael, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
This morning I was getting ready and I actually realized for the first time that I have just passed 25 years of being a prosecutor. October 26th or 27th, last year, I guess now, was my 25th year of being a prosecutor. It was a lifelong dream because that's what I wanted to do from high school days, college days, why I went to law school. And I've had some amazing opportunities as a prosecutor. And that's my intro. That's what I really enjoy doing.
So let's talk about before you knew that this was what you were going to do. What kind of child were you? These are leading questions.
I had one rough year. I had a ninth grade year where school became optional. Following the rules became very optional. There was a fear that I was not going to pass the ninth grade and went off the rails on the wrong track. And I had a civics teacher who, for some reason, took an interest in me and had me read a book that kind of changed my life. It was called The Defense Never Rests by F. Lee Bailey. And it was a compilation of courtroom drama stories from his actual cases that he had defended. And I read that book and was in awe of the criminal justice process, but knew that I didn't want to be a defense attorney. I knew I needed to be a prosecutor. And that changed everything from that point forward.
So into law school, straight out of undergrad. Mm-hmm. And you started at the Arapahoe?
Started as an intern in the Arapahoe County, Colorado District Attorney's Office. Worked there my entire third year of law school, but they treated me like an attorney.
Yeah.
I had my own docket. I tried my own cases. I think by the time I graduated law school, I had tried 11 or 12 jury trials. My dad at the time was a lawyer, also a civil attorney, and I graduated law school having prosecuted and tried more cases than he had in his career. So it was an interesting family dynamic.
So that's the gist of how you got into it. Take us through a little bit more of what your career has been like over the last 25 years.
Oh, quarter of a century.
You don't have to say that. Oh, my God.
I was very, very fortunate to have some phenomenal supervisors early on. Like I said, my first year in the office was as an intern, but basically I was treated as an attorney and did my own thing. By the time I was a year out of law school, I had gotten hired by the DA's office, contingent on passing the bar exam. Luckily, I passed the first time. And within a year, I was the county court supervisor down in Douglas County, Colorado, supervising young attorneys. Within 8 months or so, I was being promoted to district court back up in Arapahoe County, tried my first homicide case in early 1999, which for me was a career goal. I always thought in law school, you know, before I retire, I want to be able to prosecute a homicide case. All of a sudden, I've gotten one done within 2 years of being a prosecutor.
Do you know how many you've done now?
I've lost count. I could count, but
ballpark
20 or 25. Something like that. Yeah, I just lost count.
Yeah.
I spent 2 years voluntarily in our Crimes Against Children unit. And I say voluntarily because I had a great supervisor named Eva Wilson who told us that she needed top quality prosecutors to prosecute, you know, the worst of the worst, but she would never put anybody in that position who didn't want to do them. And I volunteered to do them. I stayed there for about 2 years and then had a realization that it was time for me to move on from doing those kinds of cases. About 2 years in, went back to prosecuting gun violence crimes. And in 2004, I became a political refugee. It's the best way I can describe it.
Tell us more about that.
The 2004 election, we have term limits in Colorado for prosecutors, for elected district attorneys. And my boss at the time, Jim Peters, was term limited. So there was a contested election with Eva, who I mentioned, and another in-house candidate who I didn't care for particularly. And so I campaigned very hard for Eva. We all were of the belief that she would be a phenomenal elected DA. And unfortunately, she lost for some inexplicable reason. And so seven of us in the office at the time, there were probably 70 prosecutors at the time, seven of us were informed by letter on our chair that we would not be welcome back come swearing in day in January of 2005. So rather than give that prosecutor, that district attorney, the satisfaction of firing me, I resigned and was fortunate enough in fairly short order to be offered a position as a chief deputy district attorney, as a supervisor in the Weld County District Attorney's Office, which is where I'm at now. And so I was sworn in as a chief deputy in January of 2005.
Okay. Which leads us to Weld County.
Weld County.
Which is where we are now. And then tell us about the governor and all of the things. You're almost there. We're almost through the bio.
Almost through my career. 2005, I'm sworn in as a chief deputy. In November of 2007, I was promoted to assistant district attorney, which in our office in Colorado is the number two in the office. And my boss at the time was about to begin running for the United States Senate, had a very hotly contested election and narrowly lost that election in, was that 2012?
12.
That was a 2012 election. In 2014, he decided to run for House of Representatives. Maybe it was 2010. Oh, I'm going to question that. We'll have to look.
I think it's anyway, 10. You're right.
Long and the short of it was, he was elected to Congress in the 2014 election, which of course left a vacancy in the district attorney's office since he was midterm. And I had to go through the formal process of trying to have the governor of Colorado appoint me, which was touch and go, a little bit nerve wracking because he is of a very different political party and very different political view from me and most of Weld County. And I was fortunate enough to be appointed, was appointed and was sworn in on January 3rd of 2015. I had to run for election in 2016, was fortunate enough not to have an opponent, was fortunate enough again in 2020 to run unopposed again. And should I choose to do so, I have one more opportunity to run in 2024. And that's an open question.
Okay. So that's now.
That's how we got to where I am today.
Kara, input.
I don't really have any yet.
Okay.
I have nothing. This is the most boring guest we've ever had.
No,
because usually when we're like, hey, tell us about your story, not at all. I think the big thing that we want to talk about with you today is more about this idea of trauma impacting not just the primary victim. That we hear the term vicarious trauma quite a bit, but there's a lot of secondary victims that it impacts. I already know the answers to these questions, which is one thing that I have always internalized that you've said, never ask a question that you don't already know the answer to.
That's only on cross-examination.
I know, but it's right here for now. Talk about some of the moments that stick out to you. I mean, Kara refers to them as she remembers snapshots. I talk about before and after. Everyone who's been through trauma, capital T or lowercase t, has these things that are just filed away in their brains. And I know you've got quite a few of them. So yeah, tell us a little bit about those.
Sit back.
Wherever you want to start.
Everybody grabs your popcorn.
Popcorn?
I'll focus some of my comments specifically to me. And then I know the idea is to get out beyond me, beyond prosecutors, beyond law enforcement, and talk about secondary individuals generically. But starting with me as a prosecutor, growing up in the career that I just described, there was no such thing as secondary trauma, vicarious trauma. It just wasn't something that we acknowledged or recognized as impacting prosecutors or employees of district attorney's offices. The earliest, I think, really significant traumatic moment for me was the first autopsy I attended. I talked about the first homicide trial I did was in 1999, but I was asked to jump on that case kind of midway through before the case went to trial. So I wasn't at the crime scene. I wasn't at the medical examination, the forensic autopsy of the victim in that case. I remember a traumatic event from that trial. And I think I've told you this story, and sometimes people laugh at me, but it was affectionately referred to as the time Michael almost headbutted the victim's mother while she's on the stand. First murder trial, we had called, I think, one or two witnesses. The mother of our victim was my first witness, and she was significant because, unfortunately, in the course of that homicide, she had found her son's body. The law enforcement agency hadn't set the crime scene perimeter up large enough. She had responded to try to figure out where her son was, and she's the one that discovered him. And so in the midst of me asking these questions, of course, she starts crying. Well, I'm going to be the big bad prosecutor who's going to come to the rescue of somebody who's having an emotional moment on the stand. And I grabbed a box of Kleenex and I started walking up to the witness stand, forgetting that there were cabling across the courtroom floor for our computers and for speakers and things like that. And I caught my foot and started to fall headfirst into the witness stand where she's located. And I kind of blacked out because I don't remember anything else that happened, but I was told later by my trial partner that there was a significant audible gasp from the jury box.
Yeah.
As I'm catching myself inches from headbutting her in the head.
Okay, I vaguely remember that story, and now I'm reimagining it. The circumstances are terrible, but like,
right.
Thank God for a little levity.
And I'm sorry, I got off track because I wanted to share that, because it's those kinds of things that stick out in your mind as you work your way through a career. But the first very significant, I think, traumatic moment in my career, like I said, was my first autopsy. And it was of an 11-year-old boy named Antonio Davalos, who had gone missing in January of, I think it was 2000. And I happened to be on call as one of the prosecutors on call for the next homicide. He was unfortunately found 3 days later, stuffed in a duffel bag, thrown into a dumpster. And it's wintertime. It's Colorado. He's frozen solid. And so I remember going to the medical examiner's office the day he was recovered and watching the process of him being removed from the duffel bag. And I remember how small he was. He was 11 years old. And I remember trying not to think about what I was looking at, but at the same time, trying to be helpful to law enforcement, being a representative of our office. And I went back for his autopsy the next day because, I'm sorry, without being too crass, they had to thaw him out before they could do an autopsy. Yeah. And I made it about 10 minutes in that autopsy before I had to leave. And it wasn't the sights, it was the smells and the sounds that will forever stick with me. And that's the first time I really remember experiencing something that could be classified today as trauma. But you didn't talk about it. I was made fun of by investigators, jokingly. I mean, not in a mean-spirited way. I was given a stick of gum and said, you need to get back in there and finish your observation of the process. And I was expected to go about my job, do our jobs, make our observations, and then go try that case. Luckily, that one, from a prosecutorial standpoint, had a very fortunate outcome because it was my quickest guilty verdict in any of the murder trials I've done. The jury convicted that offender in 47 minutes of first-degree murder. The one that really sticks out at me before I talk about the one that I know you want me to talk about is I was the assistant DA, and about Thanksgiving time, November of 2010, we had a very, very unfortunate circumstance where a high-speed chase turned into sheriff's deputies in our community going hands-on trying to extricate a bad guy from a vehicle. He unfortunately got a hold of the deputy's weapon and shot and killed the deputy with that weapon. I was on call. I was out at that scene, and I remember thinking about what the prosecution ultimately would look like. At the time, Colorado still had the death penalty. And so I remember having the conversation very quickly about whether or not this was going to be a death penalty case with my boss. And we got back to work that day. At the time that that homicide of that sheriff's deputy happened, his wife worked in our office. And so it not only had an impact on our office from a perspective of losing a law enforcement officer in our community generally, but losing a member of the DA family. And I got a call from one of our victim services folks saying that they were having some grief counseling and debriefing sessions that they were willing to invite our office to. I asked my boss if he wanted me to publicize that, and he looked at me deadpan and said, the best thing everybody can do is get back to work. We didn't recognize trauma. We didn't recognize the impact that it had not only on the deputy's wife, but the larger DA family. And I remember being furious about that. And Kim, you knew my boss. You didn't argue with him. You didn't question it. You simply did what you were told. And so I think as an office, we really missed an opportunity to address some of the trauma, the impact that had on our office. And I think it lingers with some employees today.
Yeah. And to collectively process that grief before you have to go and fill the university stadium to lay him to rest was, right. Yeah, that I
that was a bad time.
Yeah. That was prior to my involvement in the criminal justice system, but I can still remember that it doesn't happen that often, thankfully. And when it does, and it's in your community, there is a big suffering and a loss. So for those of you listening, this is one that I don't think made nearly enough national, international news for the gravity that it held. But there was a case of a missing woman in our community for many, many years. And it went unsolved, even though law enforcement had a pretty good idea of who it was. Hmm. This one is just, it's wild. And the personal impacts that you've had just make this even more memorable because now we know the family.
You want me to just narrate it?
Sure.
Okay.
Tell us about what your experience was like with that.
Okay.
And prosecuting it.
In about 2009, I got a call from Detective Mike Prill from the Greeley Police Department, who's one of my very good friends and the best investigator on the planet. And he used the name John Sandoval for the first time. And he said, are you aware that our department has been looking at the Sandoval case again, and we want you to take a look at it? And I didn't really know what he was talking about. Despite what Kim had just said, in the 5 years that I had been in the office, I hadn't really heard about this case. The Sandoval case apparently had been well known, and Tina Tornay's disappearance had been very well known back in the early, mid to late 1990s. But it wasn't a case that was on my radar screen. I just hadn't heard about it. Mm-hmm. And so when the Greeley Police Department and Mike Prill and Keith Olson and Brad Goldschmidt, who were the investigators, called and said, we want to give a case presentation to you about this case. I agreed to sit down with them, but I didn't know much about what it was. October 19th of 1995, Tina, who was part of a very well-known family here in Weld County, she was working her night shift on the oncology floor at the North Colorado Medical Center. This was a lifelong aspiration of hers. She wanted to be a nurse her entire career. She had finally put herself through school, but unfortunately had made the choice to marry a guy named John Sandoval, who was a very well-known
piece of shit
in Weld County. We had reports back to the early to mid 1980s about his criminal behavior. Every time there was an unsolved crime, Sandoval was always one that was a person of interest for local law enforcement. So October 19th of 95, Tina gets off her shift early in the morning from the hospital. She calls her sister and lets her sister Susan know that she's going over to deal with some financial affairs as the result of a separation and divorce that she and Sandoval are going through. She wanted her sister to know where she was in the event that anything happened to her. And she made an agreement that she would call her sister by early afternoon, 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, to let her know that she was okay. That call is never made. Almost immediately, Tina's family begins trying to figure out where she's at. They're calling coworkers. They're calling other friends. Tina's mom is going over to Sandoval's mother's house, is going over to Sandoval's house, which was formerly Tina's house, to try to get any information about where Tina's at. As she's standing at the doorway of Sandoval's home, Sandoval's aunt answers the door, says, well, she was here earlier this morning, but I haven't seen her since. And Tina's mom sees a jacket that she had given to Tina just within a couple of days. Very clear evidence that Tina had been there. So they call the Greeley Police Department right away. And despite what people may hear on TV, no law enforcement doesn't wait 24 hours to start doing anything. They spring into action right away. They start their own investigation. They find Tina's car about 3 or 4 blocks in a very weird parking spot behind a grocery store in an alleyway her car shouldn't be there. They search her car. They find her wallet. They find her cell phone, which was one of those really big ones back in the day in 1995. But they find that things that were in her car that if she had just taken off, she would have taken with her. They bring out a dog, and they tried this really neat thing, I guess, in 1995, where they had a scent item of Tina's, and I think they had a sock of hers. And they tried to get the dog to scent in the car off of Tina, and they didn't really get much. But what they did do was use the dog to scent on the steering wheel, gear shift, door handle, to see if the dog would track back to the last person who had driven the car. Well, that dog makes a beeline to Sandoval's house. The dog handler, who was a fairly new dog handler, she was almost a rookie at that point in time, said, well, the dog needs closure. And if we're talking about vicarious trauma and trauma, the dog needs closure. So by that time, And I'm sorry, I'm getting this a little bit out of order. But by that time, Sandoval is at the hospital, having been complaining of injuries inflicted on him by law enforcement. And I'll come back to that in a second. But the dog tracks through the emergency room, past nurses, past doctors, and basically jumps in the lap of John Sandoval, giving the dog some closure. Well, how Sandoval had ended up in the hospital, because they had law enforcement officers surveilling his house. At about 5 o'clock in the morning, his whereabouts are now unknown for about 7 hours. Sandoval came back to his home, parked in front of the house, walked into the house, and immediately jumped in the shower. A very astute patrol officer calls detectives. Detectives come out, look inside John's car, and they can see a shovel that appears to be wet and sandy, a bucket, a plastic bag. They ultimately search his car and find a handgun, a level, a flashlight that's on the end of a lanyard. I think that was all that was in his car. But as they're knocking on the door, John's aunt again answers the door and says, oh, he's not here. Well, they can see him walk from a bedroom into the bathroom in the backdrop of this fairly small brick house. Law enforcement immediately goes in to try to apprehend him before he starts destroying evidence, and he jumps out the window wearing only a pair of jeans, a t-shirt, no socks, 20-degree weather, is placed under arrest, and that's when he claims that law enforcement assaulted him. They obtain a search warrant. They search his house. In that bedroom, that bathroom, they find muddy boots that appear to have been rinsed off, clothing that shows sweat, perspiration, spotted glasses, things like that, showing that he had been out some kind of heavy physical activity involving sand. The long and the short of it was, at the time, they had a warrant out for his arrest for trespass, which he ultimately went to the Department of Corrections on, but nobody knew where Tina was. The local district attorney at the time refused to file charges for kidnapping for murder without Tina's whereabouts being known or without finding her body. So the case goes cold, and I hate using that phrase, but that's what happens. Nobody knows where Tina's at. Nobody's really actively looking for her. It's always one that bothered law enforcement and Greeley. And so, again, fast forward to 2009, they present this case to us and say, look, this case needs to be prosecuted. We know he did it. We don't have a crime scene. We don't know a murder weapon. We don't know how she's killed, but we know she's dead. There's been no contact with her for 14 years. Mm-hmm. And so after that presentation, my trial partner and I, Matt Malaro, spent a lot of time talking about it, and we decided to try it, to make an effort to prosecute that case. We both left that presentation without a doubt in our minds as prosecutors that he's the one that's responsible for this. And so we began the year-long process of really putting a case together, getting an arrest warrant passed to judge, getting him arrested. By that point in time, he's living in Las Vegas. And I remember sitting down with Tina's family, and I told them that I think that there were three significant hurdles that we had to overcome to ultimately hold him accountable. One was getting an arrest warrant, because that wasn't an easy task given the information that we had. Number two was getting by a preliminary hearing in front of a judge. And then number three, obviously, was convicting him at trial. And without going into all the specifics, unless you ask me specific questions, the long and the short of it is, in 2010, we were finally able to convict him of first-degree murder without ever having located Tina's remains.
So there's no body, no crime scene, no weapon, and no confession.
That's right. I was told, I don't know if this is accurate, and I don't want to...
Pretty amazing.
I don't want to pat us on the back too heavily, but I was told that that was the first time that that had happened in the United States. I don't know if that's true or not, but suffice to say, we were fortunate enough, after we convicted him, the FBI invited us out, us being Mike Pearl and I, to Quantico to participate in a no-body homicide symposium in April of 2011. And we sat there and listened to the other presentations that ultimately made up part of this discussion group for a week. And no one else's case had those four factors that you just identified missing. Mm-hmm. That's not the rest of the story.
This is where, for me, I feel like so far you've been recounting, and it's true crime-esque from your perspective. This is what I can't believe didn't hit international headlines and just the wild twists and turns because of how the true crime community usually consumes this stuff.
So let me put what I'm about to describe in context. As part of our investigation leading up to trial, we knew that law enforcement, the Greeley Police Department, had looked at the possibility that Sandoval may have secreted her remains in a local cemetery. John had been...
Wait, Kara, do you know this story?
No.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Don't mute.
So as part of our investigation leading up to trial, this was back in maybe the early 2000s with the advent of a local group called NecroSearch, who's responsible for, or who are a group of volunteers of all different specialties who go out and try to find clandestine grave sites. They volunteer their time, they volunteer their equipment, they come in and testify when necessary. But they had looked at the possibility that Sandoval had buried or hid Tina's remains in a local cemetery. They went so far as to know through their investigation that the night Tina disappeared, there were three open graves that had been dug for funerals in the day or two after her disappearance. We also knew from that investigation that if there was a morning burial, so we're talking about the morning of October 20th of 1995, the afternoon and evening of the 19th, the grave would have been dug and they would have put at the bottom of that grave a concrete pad that ultimately the casket would be lowered onto, a concrete vault would be put over the top of, and then the burial would occur. If it was an afternoon burial, they wouldn't put that concrete pad into the bottom of the grave until the morning of service, the burial. They looked into that possibility. They investigated it to the extent they could. And so we knew what three graves were open. We had taken one last swing, for lack of a better word, at the command staff at Greeley PD when we were getting ready for trial and said, can we have NecroSearch go out and do ground penetrating radar to see if we can find something underneath one of those graves? And I remember the investigations lieutenant looking at me and said, you all committed to trying this case as a nobody homicide. I don't have the manpower or the resources, financial resources, to do that at this point, so we're not going to do it. So we didn't do it. So I talked about we convicted Sandoval at trial. It was a month-long trial. We called 137 witnesses. We had over 400 exhibits. The jury convicted him after 19 days of trial in 7 hours, and off to the Department of Corrections for life without parole he goes. That was in 2010.
And that was the longest case to that point in Weld County history, correct?
True. Longest criminal trial in Weld County history. Fast forward to March of 2015. I'm now the elected DA for 2 months, and we knew that the case was working its way through the appellate courts in Colorado. I said 15, didn't I? 16. Yeah. Excuse me, March of 16. So I had been a DA for a year and 3 months. We had worked with the Colorado Attorney General's office to try to maximize what we thought was our potential of getting that conviction affirmed on appeal. And in March of 16, the Court of Appeals reversed his conviction, finding that there were several errors that occurred during his trial, which required him to have a new trial. Sandoval was a prolific jail call maker. He was on phones all the time. And so one of the first things we did, knowing that we were going to have to retry this case, was I had Detective Prill go to the Colorado Department of Corrections and get downloads of every phone call he had made while he was in prison. And we walked into our trial courtroom in early 16, and the judge said, when can you all be ready for trial again? And this was kind of calculated on our part. We made the record in front of the judge that, you know, we're getting additional evidence. The defense is going to have to review it. But we have gotten every jail call he's made in the past 6 years that we're going to be reviewing, and the defense is going to need to review as well. And so we set the case out for a status conference several months down the road. And the next day, I got a phone call from Sandoval's attorney, and she said, I have information from my client that the Greeley Police Department and your office and the Tournier family is probably going to want to hear. And I said, is he finally going to tell us the location of her body? And she said, perhaps. So the next day, or maybe that later that afternoon, the defense attorney came over to my office, and basically we worked out an agreement where I obviously had to talk to Tina's family, but if we could reach a resolution that would involve him pleading guilty to a certain number of years, he would reveal the location of Tina's body. So imagine the phone call that I had to make to the Tournier family about what I just described to you. And within a day or two, mom, dad, 5 sisters, were all in my office. Tina had 2 brothers who live on the East Coast. They were both on the phone, and there was not unanimity amongst that family about what to do. But I remember Tina's mom looking at me, leaning in towards me, and she said, I want you to do whatever it takes to get my daughter back. And it feels much like we had to make a deal with the devil, because we did. The agreement ultimately was he would plead guilty to second-degree murder, which is a lesser offense in Colorado, for, I think the agreement was 25 or 27 years in the Department of Corrections, but It mandated him telling us where Tina's body was found. This is the surreal part. He takes us, he's in the Weld County Jail, he gets checked out by law enforcement and drives us directly to that cemetery that I was talking about earlier. And he wanders around in part of the cemetery for a bit to orient himself. and finally walks over and stands over the grave of a man who very clearly on his headstone was a World War II veteran. And he said, "She's under that." Obviously, we had done our homework leading up to that. That was one of the three graves that was open that night. That was the only grave that had an afternoon burial. So the concrete pad hadn't been put in the bottom of that gravesite yet. So then Detective Prill and I had to make a phone call to this gentleman's family who lived in Cheyenne and describe what had happened.
Imagine that phone call out of the blue, right, though. You want to talk about ripple effect and right, creating more victims.
Right. And secondary trauma for somebody who was never an intended victim or the family of an intended victim. Mm-hmm. I gotta tell you, that was such an amazing son and daughter-in-law. Within an hour of our phone call, they said, "We will do whatever we can do to help you." They were at the, I can't remember if it was the sheriff's office or the police department in Laramie, Wyoming, signing a consent to have their father, his grave, exhumed so we could get underneath that grave. That happened the next day. Necrosearch was out there, and about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we found Tina's remains.
I think the other cool part about this, Mike Prill, the investigator, is a veteran as well. And as soon as everyone saw the, holy crap, we have to exhume a World War II veteran, they called the VA, I believe, and right, they had colors posted. And so I don't know, that can't happen often at all, but they came out and were posted while he was exhumed. The family came down to make sure that they were there. And I heard all of this secondhand from Mike and all the coworkers and everything, but I just kept thinking about the family coming down from Wyoming with little to no time and just being all in to help no matter what.
The thing that sticks out to me the most after it was abundantly clear that the remains we were finding underneath this grave were Tina's was a phone call that I made to Tina's sister, Susan, who had been the victim representative the whole time throughout all this process. And all I could say to her was, "We found her," and she started crying, and it was, that was a highlight.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for
so we were invited to, they had a, finally, after many, many years, a formal Catholic funeral for Tina. We were invited to that. They had a private graveside, burial service that Mike and I and Matt and Greg Tharp, who was another investigator, we were invited to. So we jokingly said to them after many years of this that we became surrogate members of the Tournay family, to the point where Susan was at my 50th birthday party.
Yeah. Yep.
So that was kind of neat.
Yeah. I mean, it can't be understated how much you all took that as, you know, this is personal. This is not just another case. It is emotional, and it's not just for that one. It's a lot of them.
Kara, for your edification, I'm sorry that took so long. What I just described, I've done presentations on that case for 3 hours. So I tried to summarize. I know it was too long.
No. So I have a follow-up question for you.
Sure.
So what I heard you say is that you really became emotionally and personally involved in this case. Mm-hmm. And I know when I worked in law enforcement, you know, one of the things that we very often are told is that you can't get emotionally involved in these cases. Because honestly, if you do, it just drags you down and you wouldn't make it. But what I have experienced and what I have heard you say that it seems like you have experienced is the cases in which you tend to inadvertently get the most emotionally involved in, they become personal. And a lot of the time they have the best outcome, but they also open you up to the most trauma.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good way to describe it. I think that in part what you've described drives what I say to victims' families when I meet them for the first time. Because you're right, the ones that we become emotionally invested in, we perform the best in, at least in my experience. When we get to that point, we are setting ourselves up for the potential that either we can't get to a trial, we can't get charges filed, we get an acquittal. We recognize that we're setting ourselves up for that. But at the same time, I know the best that I have represented my community and the best I've done for a victim's family is when I am very emotionally invested, because it drives me every day to do what I need to do. When I sit down with a victim's family, I tell them that I'm never going to promise them a certain outcome. I can't. But what I will promise them is we will work our tails off to try to get the right result. And at the same time, what I'm telling them is, you know what? You have the right to be present. You have the right to be heard at all of these different hearings. I need you there, because there are going to be days where we are dragging and we're exhausted. And when I look back and I see a packed courtroom, or I see even the mom and dad of a victim, that drives me to do my best. And so it may not always be the most healthy way to go about prosecuting a case. And you're exactly right. But I have found that we get the best results when we are working tirelessly for a case that means a lot to us. And I think we'll probably talk about it in a little while, but Janelle is the other one.
Yeah.
That, man, I wish I had a dollar for every hour we spent on working on that case. But
yeah.
But you're right. It's a reality of what we do. And I think that all, not just prosecutors, but law enforcement will tell you, just like you talked about, Kara, we do the best when we are emotionally invested. We have made a connection with the victim's family, and we are trying our level best to hold somebody accountable for what had happened to that family.
Hey, Kara, did you know that April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month? Yes, of course you did.
Obviously, I knew that. But did you know that it's also Adaptogen April?
Say what?
Do you know what an adaptogen is, Kim?
I understand all of those words separately.
So adaptogens are essentially some type of compound botanical that goes into your body and helps your body deal with stress. It's non-toxic, non-specific, and normalizing. So what it does is it helps regulate your stress hormones and helps you adapt to stress.
I have some of that, the stress.
Yeah. The good news is that Cured, almost all of their products have adaptogens. So it's Adaptogen April, and they are really doing a push on education around adaptogens. And it is genuinely something that makes them extra amazing. My favorite products with adaptogens are the Rise, the Zen, and the Aura, but they are also in the Serenity Gummies. That's the ashwagandha that you see there. So if that sounds like something you would like to try, head on over to curednutrition.com. Use code KARA10 at checkout to get an extra discount and to support us, and let us know what you think.
My favorite platform to be on right now is Patreon, because I freaking love our captive audience.
Oh my gosh, me too. I think that the conversations over there are so authentic, so genuine. And honestly, because you're choosing to be there, hopefully you really, really like us and you're not going to think that we need to be committed when we are completely unhinged.
I love those conversations. I also love that we've got merch that's available over there and a bunch of extra video episodes. To be able to watch it and have that feedback from the folks who are there that make up our little Patreon community is just so much fun.
Like the real unhinged pterodactyl laughing and me just saying all kinds of weird things that Kim sometimes cuts into episodes. If you like those little kind of things, then you're going to like our Patreon.
But you also get bonus content, early access and news, and the input that we get from our Patreons really shapes what we are doing with this show. So if you're interested, please join us over on Patreon.
You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/SGTC for Survivor's Guide to True Crime.
And you can find that on our website or in the show notes.
So on that note, I would assume that being open to being emotionally involved in cases means that you also have cases which have impacted you, have been especially memorable for certain reasons. So one case in particular, I know a lot of people are going to know. So I want you to talk about it because it's one of your most memorable cases.
Just don't make me say his name.
All right.
Because I refuse to do that. I refer to this now as the Frederick homicide case, triple homicide.
Yeah.
And again, I'm going to get dates wrong because apparently I just can't remember dates anymore.
You have a lot to remember, in all fairness.
Like the amount that you do remember.
Yeah, you have a 25-year career here, so it's okay. And honestly, I don't think that it is necessary to say offenders' names most of the time, because I think that... Yes. Too much focus is placed on that. You know, it's the case of the, you know, Zodiac killer, whatever. We know these names. We know Ted Bundy, but we don't know the victims' names. And I think that's something that media gets wrong. And I understand why it happens. So we're in full support of that mentality.
And there's the No Notoriety campaign. We can include a link to that as well. I mean, and sometimes it's important to have the public safety if you're like looking for someone or something. But once that person is on trial, convicted, whatever it might be, you don't have to use their name anymore. You really don't. It's not worth it.
You notice I just did that a minute ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's Janelle's case.
Yeah.
It's not that other guy's name.
No.
Anyway, the Frederick triple murder happened in August of 2018. And it started off with not a lot of notoriety. And really the long and the short of it was Shanann had gone on a work trip to Phoenix with some of her colleagues. She came home from the airport the night of August 13th of 2018. And we know now, had a discussion with the defendant about their marital future. In the very early morning hours of her return from the airport, she and her 4-year-old and 3-year-old daughter go missing. The defendant, I'm going to continue to refer to him as the defendant, is one of the first, but not the first, to call law enforcement to notify them of their disappearance. He is seen through local media channels standing on his front porch, begging and pleading, and I put that in air quotes, for them to be returned safely, trying to find information, wanting them back, talking about how difficult it is to sleep and to eat, knowing that they have disappeared. And it struck particularly our law enforcement, experienced law enforcement agents, very oddly. And
it struck me oddly. I'm watching it happen on the news, and I don't know if it was live or just like the next segment.
Right.
And you got home in the middle of it. I remember I'm standing at the back of the couch. I was like, oh, he did it. There was nothing, nothing there.
Within a couple of days, he is brought into the Frederick Police Department, is interviewed by detectives and agents from the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. And after a few hours of some very good interrogation, ultimately admits that he is responsible for their death. During the course of that interview, he shows on overhead diagrams where his family is now buried. It's an oil battery site down in the south part of Weld County. And for those who don't know what an oil battery site is, in rural Colorado and parts of this country, you'll see the oil tanks just kind of out in the middle of a field somewhere. It'll have a dirt road leading to it. There'll be some other smaller equipment there, but that is basically either an oil storage facility or an active natural gas drill site. He describes to law enforcement that in these two oil tanks that you can see at this battery, he has put his one daughter, Bella, in one, Celeste in the other, and then Shanann is buried in a shallow grave, and she's pregnant at the time with her son, Nico, is buried in a shallow grave 50, 75 yards off of this dirt road. Some incredible law enforcement agents from Frederick Police, CBI, hazmat teams from the Colorado State Patrol, local oil and gas employees go out to that site the next morning at daybreak, because this is after dark, but he's describing this. And they go through the arduous task of having to drain those oil tanks to see if they can find the remains of these two little girls. And ultimately they did. They found Shanann's remains in a very shallow grave, just as the defendant describes it. And we know at this point we have a triple murder. And unfortunately, in Colorado, there's not a recognition by way of victim for the unborn child. But we do have a murder of a pregnant woman, which ultimately the defendant was charged with, as well as these three murders. This immediately, for a variety of reasons, gained national, international attention. We started getting emails of support or demanding justice from all over the country. I remember getting emails as far away as South Africa, Scotland, New Zealand, all over Europe, a lot from the United Kingdom, like I said. And so we have the burden now at this point, like I said, 2018, I'm the elected district attorney, of deciding whether or not to seek the death penalty for this particular defendant. Knowing that working its way through the legislature is going to be a bill to eliminate the death penalty for consideration in the state of Colorado. But I wanted to make sure that we were doing the right thing for Shanann's family. And so Steve Wren, my chief deputy, and I flew to North Carolina and went to Shanann's parents' house to sit down with them in their living room to talk to them about the process, what they wanted to see happen, the realities of death penalty litigation in Colorado. And that's just not something you can have a conversation over the phone about. Ultimately, the outcome of that was a split. I mean, one parent wanted the death penalty. The other, Shanann's father, wanted us to make sure that this defendant never saw the light of day. And ultimately, he did plead guilty to everything we charged him with in exchange for not seeking the death penalty. A decision that, in hindsight, I'm very comfortable with, because about 6 months later, the legislature eliminated the death penalty from the state of Colorado, and our governor commuted the sentences of those on death row to life without parole. And so we were able to obtain that swift and certain sentence for her family without having to go through protracted litigation, only to have a governor come in unilaterally and say, never mind, we're going to eliminate the death penalty. But you want me to talk about the part that really bothers me, and so I will.
So it's always just interesting. And I think that this is probably true for anyone listening. When you have people telling a story like this, that they have firsthand experience, they're telling you one thing. And I'm sitting here hearing your words, but going through all the memories that I have of either you coming home as soon as he confessed and tears in your eyes saying he did it, to all the other things that were happening behind the scenes that people never see because they're not on a headline. And, you know, it took us a while to get here, but that's what we think is important for you to talk about.
This is the case that caused me to realize that secondary or vicarious trauma in prosecutors is a real thing and something that we have to talk about and we have to address. And we can't just say, go back to work and everything will be okay. One night while we were working through this case, I had brought my laptop home like I always do. And I remember looking at you saying, if I'm going to make a decision about whether or not to subject someone to the ultimate penalty, I've got to look at everything. And I had intentionally not looked at crime scene photos. I wasn't there. I made the choice not to go down there when they recovered the remains. I hadn't looked at them.
What made you decide not to do that at that time?
I think without recognizing it, I think that there was the recognition that I couldn't or I shouldn't for my own well-being. Mm-hmm. I think part of it was respect for those victims. They didn't need onlookers there that didn't need to be there. But I think that part of it simply was, I don't need to see that. I know what I've seen enough deceased people in my life. I didn't need to see that. I didn't need to see children.
Yeah. Tell us more about why you felt that you didn't need to see that.
Sure. I think, well, I'll be candid.
Yeah, because you found out that you really didn't need to see that, right?
Oh, yeah. I found out the hard way. Bella and Celeste were, like I said, 3 and 4 year old little girls with very long, glowing blonde hair who liked to run around the living room, dance, sing, and do cartwheels. We knew that because we had some social media posts that Shanann had put on her Facebook page or Instagram, one of them. And so I watched those and I saw those little girls, and my own daughter at the time was about that same age, long blonde hair, doing cartwheels in my living room, despite the fact she knows that's a family rule not to. And there was an immediate connection that I felt with those little girls because of my daughter. I couldn't go watch them be extricated from a oil tank soaked in oil, not knowing at that point in time whether they were alive or dead when they were put in that tank. The hole at the top of the tank that those little girls were put in was 8 inches in diameter. Stop and think about that for a minute and think about the size of a 3 and a 4 year old and how those bodies get in an 8 inch diameter hole. That piece of shit shoved them in those holes. I didn't need to see that. I couldn't see that. So back to the night where I come home from work, I know that we're contemplating seeking the death penalty. And as the elected DA, that's my decision. That's not anybody else's. I'm going through a process of talking to law enforcement, community leaders, my own commissioners for budget reasons, her family, like I have talked about, senior leadership in my office, and my wife, because there's a recognition that this is the ultimate decision I have to make. I'm going to take somebody's life if litigation goes the way it should in this case. And I can't make that decision without seeing the impact of what he had done. And so I opened up my computer one night, sitting on the couch in our living room, watching my daughter over here playing on the living room floor. And I opened up, I maybe got 5 or 6 pictures in, and I'll never forget them. They are burned in my brain. And it was like I blacked out. I had to stop. And I looked at Kim and I said, I can't do this. That's when vicarious trauma became a real thing.
I'll never forget. I was sitting cross-legged on the floor. So we have a coffee table, and I was working on something on the computer, and I knew that that's what he was doing. So it was like our computers are, the backs of them are facing each other. And I saw his face just, I don't still have a hard time recalling that in anything than less than perfect detail, because it was just watching every fiber shift in you, and it became part of you and who you are and what you do, and it doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it hasn't gone away to this day.
Mm-mm. But of course, that's not what you were going to talk about when you have a press conference or when people are doing, you know, podcasts on it or whatever else. But that's what I remember.
You'll remember this part too, and this is the part that has never happened before. After the defendant pled guilty, we had set for a sentencing hearing because I knew that her family wanted to be present. And I wanted to make sure that we were being articulate, respectful, complete, because our community didn't know what had happened from a detail standpoint.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't know the answer to some of the questions that I just had thrown out there. They didn't know much of anything. And I knew with all the attention that this was garnered that I was going to have to get up and reveal to the world the details that we had kept out of the media for reasons that are unique to prosecutors. I can't talk about pending cases to the media. I won't do it. And so I had two of my more senior attorneys, Steve, who I talked about, who went to North Carolina with me, Rob Miller, who's my assistant DA, and Kim and I sat in my basement and spent 3 hours, 3.5 hours working through exactly what a sentencing argument was going to look like so that we could, A, do justice to the vileness of what this piece of shit did, but do it in a way that was respectful and would be hopefully well received by the community.
I remember sitting there, we were throwing questions at you too, as if it's like a press event afterwards, just so that you wouldn't get super emotional and you felt like you were doing the family and the victims justice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was something.
So that, for those who haven't heard about that case before, don't spend a lot of time looking at it because it ruins your conscience.
Yeah.
But it was one that changed who I was as a prosecutor, I think changed this community. It certainly changed law enforcement. We lost an incredible detective from law enforcement because that was the straw that broke his back. He had to retire from law enforcement because of that case, plus some others that he had worked on. And I remember doing an interview with the Denver Post, and ultimately what I said became the headline, right, wrong, or indifferent. But I said that case changed all of us, and it did. From that day forward, I have recognized and tried to implement in our office and on a statewide basis wellness programs for prosecutors because those didn't exist. Today, it exists in maybe a third of the offices. We have finally created a very good peer support program in our office. We have recognized that this isn't just something that is felt by the prosecutors who are standing up in front of a jury, but it's felt by our investigators, by our victim advocates, notably by our secretaries, who have to look at those files and read these reports all day, every day, and they don't have an outlet for it. They don't get to stand up in front of a jury and pound on a table and thunder away about what the defendant had done. They have to take that stuff home. And so the recognition is that all of us involved in this process, from law enforcement to the secretaries at law enforcement, victim advocates, up through our prosecutors, are all impacted by the horrifying things that people do to one another.
So to your comfort level, all of that happened, the sentencing hearing, you have all of the media coverage. And, you know, this is one thing we talk about with true crime sleuths is that they'll want to go on and play detective from home. And Shanann's entire profile is all public. And so you have countless hours of videos, pictures, posts, nuances, all kinds of things that they can go through and they feel like they are part of the case. When that happens, what does that do? I mean, to you as the prosecutor or the head of the office, what are some things that like people who are constantly doing this can take away from it?
That happened, like I said, August 13th of 2018. It is now early 2023. Every single day since that homicide, Shanann's family has been tortured, re-victimized, traumatized by producers who want to do Lifetime movies and by reporters who want to scoop the rest of the country by getting a soundbite from Shanann's mom, to foreign, again in air quotes, journalists who have on a daily basis, and I don't even call him journalists, he's a piece of shit podcaster in Scotland who has gotten to the point where he has taken this tragedy and exploited it for his own financial benefit, has made multiple requests of my office for records that I refuse to release, has gone so far as to say that I am communicating with him incognito in press conferences by the way I blink, and is... I'm pausing because I'm trying to not swear too much, but there have been efforts through social media outlets here in the United States to try to ban him from what he's doing. And there's not a mechanism for that to happen. And so all of these repeated requests, let me back up one step. In this case, it was a fairly short prosecution in that there wasn't a year-long investigation and a ton of follow-up interviews. So we still had 4,000 or 5,000, maybe 6,000 pages of reports and cell phone downloads, photographs, all of those kinds of things. The demand from the public, once his case was resolved, for open and complete access, either through Criminal Justice Records Act, FOIA requests, in Colorado, it's called the Colorado Open Records Act, was crushing. I have an office of 80 employees, and I bet if we would have done this any other way, all 80 of my employees would have been responding to nothing but these requests. So we had to make the choice of making the files that we would release public available on our website, office website, through a program called ShareFile, where people could simply request it, they'd get the link, and they could download, and they could sit at home and read. The number of people that have done that is stunning. We are talking multiple tens of thousands of downloads worldwide of this horrific crime that I have described.
I wish I could say that's surprising, but I think one of the things that compels people with crimes like this, and I think true crime in general, is they see a crime like this and they go, how on earth does someone do something so heinous? And I think a large percentage of the population that consumes true crime, they consume it because they're trying to understand. But I think that the thing to remember is there is no excuse. There is no, how did someone get this way? You're not going to read this file and do anything other than vicariously traumatize yourself, basically. But people want to try to understand.
I agree with that in part. I also have seen, from my perspective, the number of people who have wanted to play junior detective.
Yeah, I think that's the other side of true crime as well. Yep.
They want to play junior detective. They want to second guess charging decisions. They want to second guess whether or not the offender is truly guilty. They want to second guess the sentencing determination that I had to make. And in this one, in my description earlier, I didn't share this piece, but at the same time, we knew through the course of our investigation that the defendant was having an affair with somebody that he had met at work. And there was the significant belief by many that she played a role in this murder. The most recent email I have gotten demanding that I reopen the investigation and prosecute her for murder, I received last week. I bet conservatively we have gotten 5,000 or 6,000 emails demanding the same thing, questioning the very decision-making process that we had gone through without having all the information. We get phone calls from people who say, you know, I want you to justify or articulate why you made this decision. And I'm not going to do that. I just refuse. It's gotten to the point where about 2 years ago, I finally decided I'm not doing any more interviews. I'm not doing any more documentaries. I'm not doing any made-for-TV movies. Nothing. I have got to get out of talking about this particular case.
Thank you for being on our program.
And then you dragged me back in.
And so for clarity, that avenue has been investigated. It is closed. Period. That's it.
Period.
So stop asking about it.
Stop asking about it. She didn't have anything to do with it. She wasn't there that morning. She voluntarily cooperated with law enforcement. She provided us all the information. I'm not going to tell you where she's at. Stop. Leave me alone.
Because ultimately, she is a victim in ways as well. So leave her the hell alone. Leave y'all alone about it. Leave her alone. And I mean, one of the things that I have heard someone say before in reference to people who commit these kinds of heinous crimes is at the end of the day, you may say that this person went through something in their childhood that loaded the gun, or maybe they have some sort of mental imbalance or illness that loads the gun. But at the end of the day, he decided to pull the trigger metaphorically, and it's no one's fault but his. So that's all there is to it.
And he was interviewed after he was sentenced, after he was sent out of state to the Department of Corrections. My detective from Frederick and CBI agent went out to interview him after the fact to try and get a sense of some of the things you're talking about. Why this happened? Why did you do this? And out of his own mouth, again, was a very clear affirmation of what he had done, in what order he had done things. Some of the horrific details that we don't need to go into, but she didn't do it. She had nothing to do with it. Leave her alone.
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, we can definitely be done with this case. And I think the reason that I personally, this is something that Kim and I talk about often, is that we in general do not consume much true crime, but much like you, you know, both of you, our children were similar ages when this happened. So my children would have been, so your daughter was how old then? Like three, she was, four?
She would have been 3.5.
Yeah. So my boys would have been 2 and 4. So similar ages. And I know my husband similarly does not really consume true crime, but this case impacted him so strongly just from afar. And this is before we knew you guys. This is before, you know, we had any inside connection, so to speak, to this case. And it impacted my husband profoundly because he was a relatively new father and he just couldn't even comprehend it. And so for our family, it had an impact. And that's why I found it important to ask you to speak on this because, you know, one of the things that we forget so often in true crime, which is one of the reasons Kim and I wanted to do this podcast, is that there are people at the heart of these stories that we hear, you know, that you want to investigate at home. There are actual humans that this is the worst day of their life. But then there's this ripple effect where there's all of these other people that were impacted. And I think it's so important to highlight these secondary victims, this vicarious trauma. And remember, when you're consuming these cases, that it is profoundly impacted people's lives, and to not take that lightly.
Without a doubt. And in this, like I said, this impacted not just the town of Frederick, this impacted people nationwide. And every time someone picks up the phone or gets brave behind a keyboard in anonymity or otherwise and wants to criticize, second guess, lambaste, or worse, hell, I've been accused of accepting bribes from her, the mistress, from her family, not to prosecute her. I'm still waiting for that check. Apparently, I'm getting paid $80,000 not to prosecute her. Kim, let me know when that check comes through.
Yeah, we're putting it towards my student loans.
They're still there.
but like I said, there are people. And unfortunately, you know, one of the things that comes from this is right, wrong, or indifferent, for better or for worse, I get recognized because of that case now. And we're at conferences and people want to take pictures with me. I appreciate that. I get it. But you know what? All you're doing is reminding me of what was one of the worst cases of my entire career.
Yeah. Let's transition to one more case that you may have heard of before.
What case would that be, Kimberly?
The year was 2006.
We need a nice, like, sentimental overlay. Please insert nice musical background to this.
So, Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell is out of the question here?
Sure.
let's entitle this segment, I Cannot Give You Legal Advice.
you want to say that again real close to the mic here?
Really, I cannot give you legal advice.
But
your mom kept asking for it.
Your mom kept asking legal advice.
I can't give your mom legal advice.
Sorry, Deb. Just kidding. But really.
Love you mean it.
In her notebook.
Yep. So some of our listeners may not be familiar with another case that you did in 2006. Can you tell us about that one?
I took myself a prosecution of a college co-ed who had been the victim of a burglary of her apartment and sexual assault at the hands of a stranger. And at the time, I didn't realize that that was your case.
It's me. Hi, I'm the problem. It's me.
Oh boy.
So, yes. That is how we met. We didn't start dating until many, many years afterwards. But
yeah, please don't start calling me saying, oh, the ethics, there's something wrong from a professional responsibility standpoint.
It was how many years? It's like
10.
Yeah, 10.
10
yeah.
years later.
Oh.
Yeah. More than that.
No, because I would have been.
Oh, when we started dating, yeah.
Yeah, I would have been 20 and then
no, so
30.
Real quick, everybody I think probably is aware of the case that you're referring to, but it crossed my desk to make a charging decision about 3 weeks after the assault, the day after he had been arrested. And I had made the decision as the chief deputy at the time to keep that case myself. Rob Miller, I've mentioned him earlier, my assistant DA. Rob and I prosecuted that case. We finally convicted the defendant in 2007. Seven. Thank you. Me and dates again.
Uh-huh.
but yeah, Kim and I, we lost touch for a while. She came back and started working in the office in the adult diversion world. And then we started dating in 2016 and got married in 2018.
Yep.
Got that date right.
Yeah, you better.
Got that date right.
I think, you know, we have a whole episode that is about my case and all of the behind the scenes stuff. But I think what would be interesting is discuss the first time that we actually met when you had us come in kind of that rapport building conversation, because it's more interesting from your perspective, because I don't have a whole lot of first person memory.
Sure. One of the things that we do, particularly in sexual assault cases, is we want to meet with the victim and whoever else he or she wants to have present very early on in the process, because what we're trying to do as prosecutors, along with law enforcement, along with our victim advocates, is start to develop some kind of a rapport, because we know down the road, if this case goes to trial, I'm going to have to ask a victim some of the most intimate, vile, offensive, seemingly offensive questions that you could possibly imagine. And if that victim doesn't trust me, our prosecution is dead in the water before we even begin. And so within, unfortunately, sometimes for days of an assault, we are asking the victim to come into our office. And the intention is really just to sit to discuss the criminal justice system generally, because hopefully there's not a familiarity with the process and it becomes very foreign and very scary, frankly. We want to discuss the charging, the potential sentence. I want to start to get a sense of what the victim would like going forward, whether it be by plea agreement or trial or whatever the case may be. And so within a day or two of your assailant being arrested and us filing charges, we had a meeting in my conference room. And I remember you, your mom, your dad, our detective, our victim advocate, and Rob were all there to have this kind of a conversation. And one of the things I remember about the meeting very clearly is Kim sat across the conference room table from me and stared at either the table or her shoes the vast majority of the meeting. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm not developing any kind of rapport at all. She's not listening. She's not paying attention. I understand this is still traumatic, but this is not going to go well. And so I spent most of the time talking with her mom, because her mom had her notebook with question after question after question, all of them very legitimate questions. Mm-hmm. And so we spent the time going through those. But I remember thinking that I've got to try to figure out whether we're making any inroads with Kim at all. And so I said to her, I've noticed in the reports we've gotten so far that you're referred to by Kimberly. Is that what you want me to call you? And I know you don't remember this, but you looked up at me finally, one of two times, and said, people call me Kimberly. My friends call me Kim. You can call me Kim. Words to that effect. And I remember thinking, okay, at least I've gotten to the point where I am lumped in with friends and acquaintances who are comfortable calling you Kim. The other time he looked at me is when I mentioned the potential of a plea bargain somewhere down the road, and lasers and fire and brimstone shot out of your eyes and went through my skull.
Allegedly.
That happened.
That was never going to be an option.
So at least the prosecutor and the law enforcement side left that meeting with an understanding that we had started down the road of developing that kind of a rapport, where ultimately I had to and did ask you all of those horrible, vile questions about a year later.
I think a big part is that for prosecutors, you guys remember the trial and then your conviction, and that's it. That's your closure. But for us, it was sentencing and being able to get up on the stand and actually talk about the impact.
I'm going to sound like Mike Prill here. I think what you meant to ask me was,
oh, Lord,
to talk about what I perceived from a prosecutor standpoint about all of the other secondary victims that existed, not just you, your family, mom, dad, brother. Mm-hmm. Is that fair? Is that what you meant to ask me?
Shut up, Mike. Prill or Brooke.
One of the things that is most memorable about that case, I think, to me, and I know to Rob as well, is Kim was in a sorority. And so every court appearance, the entire sorority came. But it wasn't just the entire sorority. It was all the friends of the sorority and all the boyfriends of the sorority. And so there were 40, 50, 60, sometimes 80.
Yep.
People who showed up at every court hearing. Well, one of the things that we did, and I think we learned that this was beneficial, particularly in your case, after a court hearing, we would take everybody back to the jury assembly room, and we would sit there and answer questions, not from you, not from your mom or from your dad, but from everybody else, because I figured maybe if I answer the questions, you wouldn't have to. Mm-hmm. But I got a significant sense during the course of that, that everybody in that room, male, female, or otherwise, was significantly impacted by what had happened. And that was a way that we could try and address some of the secondary victimization of those others by answering questions, explaining to them the process, and making sure that they understood what had just been said in the courtroom and what was coming up next.
Yep. Yeah. And it was hugely helpful, which, you know.
I think that's so great that you were able to do that. And I think it's so important. I want to make sure that our listeners, if they maybe think that they were impacted as a secondary victim, or if they feel like they know or love someone who is in that situation, what are ways that we can support people that are in that position? What were some of the key things? You said that, you know, you listened to their questions and you tried to answer them. Obviously, that was from a prosecutorial standpoint. But just kind of in general, what are some of the things that you would think would be helpful in that type of situation?
I think the most important thing that I took from that was allowing, from my perspective, allowing those questions to be asked. Spending the time that was necessary to address some of the concerns. I think from a family or friend, acquaintance, a support person perspective, don't hesitate to ask the questions. Don't hesitate to be a support in the courtroom. Don't hesitate to pick up the phone or send an email and say, hey, my friend Jane, who's going through this process, is really struggling. And I, you know, it would really help me if, you know, you could tell me what the next step of the process is. I jokingly said at the beginning of this part of it, you know, I can't give you legal advice. And we can't. Prosecutors can't give legal advice. But we can answer questions about what's the next step in litigation? What is a preliminary hearing? What do you expect to happen at a motions hearing? Ask the questions. I'm going to work in a shameless plug, and I hope I get a high five from my wife sitting next to me. But this was something that we were doing as prosecutors before we knew what, quote, start by believing was, mm-hmm. what that program was. And it's easy for us as law enforcement or prosecutors to say, hey, when you're dealing with the victim of a sexual assault, you should start by believing what they say. It's a great campaign nationwide. But what I saw in those meetings was a community who believed what Kim had to say. And we were allowed as prosecutors and law enforcement to help in that perception by reinforcing the importance of what we were doing, the significance of the prosecution, the potential sentence, and the recognition that there was an impact on everybody in that room. And so I may be rambling a little bit here, but really that was what I took away from that was don't hesitate to be an active supporter of someone who was going through that. Don't consider them simply to be broken and wanting to avoid having contact with them, because the best thing that sometimes can happen is just having somebody there.
Yeah.
Somebody to listen, somebody to go to court with them. Mm-hmm. I hope that answers your question.
No, absolutely. I think one of the things that has come up for me time and time again in having these conversations is the ability to sit in the suffering with someone is one of the most supportive things that you can do as a support person. And if you are the kind of person that needs the answers, then most, I would say this is pretty fair, that most law enforcement and DA's offices have some sort of victim assistance personnel, right?
Right.
No. Yes. Okay. So that person would be someone that would be helpful to answer those questions. When I worked in victim services, that was a big part of what I did. You know, someone would call a family member, victim, mm-hmm. and say, what do I expect next? And so, you know, if it's a smaller agency, maybe they don't have someone that's their primary role. But the ability to get the information that you need to sit in the suffering with those people, but also address that you may also be experiencing some trauma as well and understand that, I think it's just important. And one of the things that you and your team absolutely did right when you were prosecuting Kim's case.
And one of the things that I would add to that is for those offices that are, you know, law enforcement or DA's offices, if people are listening, you are one of the small offices that doesn't have all of the resources necessary to do the things that I'm talking about. Then it falls on the cop, then it falls on the detective, it falls on the prosecutor to take the time to do it, whether you have a victim advocate in the room or not. We're prosecuting a horrific homicide right now where there's mom and there's dad. But with mom and dad come every court hearing, 15 or 20 different family members, friends, support We didn't just do what I'm talking about with Kim in her case, where we sit down in a conference room or a jury assembly room and answer questions. We're doing that now. Sometimes our victim advocate can't be there. Rob and I sit there and answer those questions for anyone in the room. I don't care if they are lawfully or in legal status a victim representative or not. They're impacted by what happened. Take the time to do it. Take the extra 10 minutes to sit there and say, do you have any questions? Do you understand what happened in the courtroom today? Kim says this all the time. I, as a prosecutor, may have 150 other cases on my docket, and I am stressed to the max to try to make sure that I am prepared for the next day in court. But for that victim and that victim's family, they have one. Take 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and answer those questions for them so that they can walk away, hopefully believing that the criminal justice system is listening to them, is responsive to what they're asking, what their concerns are. Even if you're not giving them the answers they want to hear, spend the time.
You know, one of the things that we continuously keep talking about here, I didn't know any different. Like, this was my only interaction with the criminal justice system. I didn't know that not every cop, not every prosecutor, not every state nurse did the things that people did for me. Just take
well,
your time.
You realize that that wasn't the case when you worked in the office in adult diversion and saw that that didn't happen in every.
Yeah, that was bizarre, though. Oh, you mean this doesn't happen? So when I hear cases or people talking about how theirs went wrong, it is.
Yeah.
It gut-punches me.
Yeah, I get messages like that
all the time.
Still, I'm sure you do too.
Yeah. Well, but what Kara and I talk about is, you know, don't hang your hat for healing on the justice system outcome.
Yeah.
I did that. I got insanely lucky, but
I can't, as a prosecutor, solve or make a victim whole.
Yes.
That was taken away by the offender long before it ever hits my desk. All I can do is what I've talked about, you know, for the last however long we've been talking is try to do my job as professionally as I possibly can. But you're right. I couldn't make you whole. I couldn't take back what happened. All I could do was make sure that within the bounds of ethics and the law, I prosecuted the offender and sent him away for as long as I could. Kara, when she was either a victim or law enforcement, when she was a law enforcement, couldn't make victims whole. Mm-hmm. And so what I would say is rely on the criminal justice system to do the things that we are vested with doing, which is trying to hold accountable the offenders who commit these crimes. We're not going to hold everybody accountable. We're going to miss some sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes we are at the mercy of a jury who just for some reason doesn't believe the prosecution that we have put forward. But you're right. Don't look to us to solve every problem, because there are times where I can't give you legal advice as to whether or not to file a lawsuit and seek monetary damages. I can't give you a suggestion as to how to go about getting a civil protection order, because that's not my role. But avail yourself of the other support systems that are out there independent of the criminal justice system as well. The battered women shelters for domestic violence victims, the sexual assault resource centers for victims of sexual assault, religious organizations. I mean, the list goes on and on, but you're right. I can't. We can't, as law enforcement, solve all of the world's problems and try to put victims back in the position prior to their victimization, because that's just impossible.
No. But one of the things that you can do and that you have done successfully is you can treat people like survivors as opposed to victims. And I think it's a very nuanced approach, but I think that you are definitely leading the way. You are showing people different ways to do that and how to take care of themselves in the process. And I think that's just commendable and important work. And I'm so glad that there are people like you that are in the system, because there are so many people who are overworked, underpaid, jaded. I mean, there are people who have messed up mentality in every profession. So of course, in law enforcement and, you know, the judicial process, like, there will be people that are not necessarily on the up and up. But, you know, for every one that's bad, there are, and I would say hundreds, who are amazing. And so I think it's important to remember that one of the things that I talk with law enforcement specifically about is, you know, you may have, like you said, you may have hundreds of cases, but this victim, they only have one, and the way you treat them can have a significant impact. And it doesn't mean that it has to jeopardize your case, you know, because again, for every case that lands on your desk, I would say, just from what I experienced when I was investigating child abuse and sexual assault cases, for every one case that went forward to our prosecutor, there were 15, 20 cases that I had that I could not do anything with.
Right.
And right. So it's always important to remember to treat people with respect and like survivors and like they are capable of healing. People don't always necessarily need to be treated like they're made of glass. I think that people can be treated in a way that empowers them. And I think that that's something that, that you have shown to have done in your career.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Of course.
Well, thank you for coming down to our program.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on the program.
Yeah. Okay. So
we have two questions left.
Two questions.
Yep.
I already know the answer. Do you consume true crime?
That's all I do. That's my entire job. My job, my life is true crime.
Outside of work. Outside of work. So, outside of work. Because this is Survivor's Guide to True Crime, we have to know. Do you listen to true crime podcasts?
I do not. And I love you both. I'm not going to listen to yours because, and I don't listen to them.
I mean, we don't want to listen to ourselves talk either. So it's okay.
I don't, in all seriousness, I don't. And Kim knows the answer to this. I don't come home and read true crime books. I don't come home and read fictional stories about crime or those kinds of things for a variety of reasons. But most notably, this is all I do every day. I go to work and I read police reports and I read charging documents and I read victim impact statements. I don't need to do it at home. Amen. And maybe 1A, if that's reason one, 1A is I don't
lawyer
need
of you.
To. What's that?
You're right. A lawyer of you.
Oh, I got it.
Response.
The answer to your question is it depends. Okay. But the other reason, I don't know from a prosecutor standpoint if the true crime story that's being put out has been authorized by the victim, mm-hmm, or if the victim has participated. And if it hasn't, I am not going to consume that out of respect for that victim and his or her choices. And yeah, I'm just not going to do it because I'm not going to allow someone to monetize a victim suffering for my own entertainment value.
All the snaps.
Good answer. Good answer.
It's almost like we talk about this sometimes. Almost. Yeah. Although I will say that I was really excited that Unsolved Mysteries was going to be back on. And I kind of forget that that's like the OG true crime show. Yeah. And I was introducing the kids to it. And it was like an alien one or something. He's like, I can't. So, I mean, we'll watch the news. I think especially if there's articles or things about his ongoing cases, I'm usually the one that'll review him more from like a public relations standpoint than definitely not in an informational level. But I want to make sure that they got facts correct and that sort of stuff.
The case we were talking about earlier, the Frederick case, they made a Lifetime movie out of it. Talk to any of us about it. But there was that. And there was a couple of other documentaries that you watched.
I watched the Netflix one because
Netflix, that's right.
And that is the only one that I watched to make sure that it was correct. And then I watched because her family was actually involved in that process. And I wanted to, I guess, make sure that it represented everything accurately. And that's the only one that I was like, okay, I'm not hugely pissed off over this because there wasn't the narration. Like, you know, there wasn't a Keith Morrison with ominous tones sort of.
Was it murder?
That. Yeah. But it didn't have that. Like the story told itself. But still, we'll pull up Netflix. We're going to have family movie night. Okay. And there's that face that all the kids know, and they are very familiar. Yes, dear.
I'm just sitting here thinking, I need to throw a disclaimer on what I said earlier.
Oh, God.
Because Kara asked me if I'd consume true crime or watch it on TV or things like that, and I don't. But I participate in it, and I do so voluntarily, and sounds like a lawyer, voluntarily and intelligently. Because in the next couple of weeks, we are doing interviews on Dateline and on the case with Paula Zahn about Janelle's case. Mm-hmm. I want folks to understand I am doing that with the full support of and knowledge of her family. Mm-hmm. Her family is going to participate. I would never do these if a family asked me not to, or they were opposed to it, or were not participating. And so I'd participate in these because I recognize there is the need for some family members of victims to get their story out there. And if I can help do that, I will. And so I am going to do that on this one. I've done it a few other times, but only in cases in which the victim or the victim's family is fully supportive of us doing that. Mm-hmm. There's my disclaimer.
Good. I mean, I think that's standard to aspire to, though. I think that if media aspired to the same standard, we'd be in a hell of a lot of a different position. So things would be a lot different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and it's also worth noting, it's never for your own toot your own horn right. kind of thing. Every time he's like, I have to be on TV.
And they're going to put makeup on me. I don't get paid for it.
No, but I do have a picture of him sitting across from Keith Morrison.
Keith Morrison.
Having his nose powdered. So that may be Patreon content.
Oh, yeah.
You're so pretty.
All right. Final question for you, Mike.
Yes.
People want to follow you or they want to know more about you. You don't have anywhere. They can do that, right? On Kim's, no. Kim's social media.
Mike has a cult following on my TikTok channel where if I will put out stuff about him, people are all over it and so excited. And he has a persona that he has to maintain.
Those are the videos that go viral. So sorry to ruin your persona.
What I'm trying, let's see, I'm trying to answer this seriously, given you two want to make fun of me. Yes. I don't have a social media following that I actively put stuff out there because my job's not about me.
Yeah.
It's about the cases I do. And so I'm not going to put out there what I'm doing on a particular day at work because it's not about me. So if you want to know what we do or what we're doing in my office, we've got a great website. We've got a great, it's wellda.com, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we put out press releases about the good work our office is doing. And beyond that, look at Kim's stuff.
I mean, he has like a personal account, but mostly it's for sports and reminding everyone that he hates Johnny Miller and doesn't think that he should be commentating on golf.
Yes.
Tell me I'm wrong.
No, you're not.
All right. Okay. So we always like to leave our listeners with some type of call to action, something for them to do with the story instead of just telling stories. So what would your call to action to leave with our listeners be for today?
I think what I would leave your listeners with is this. From my perspective, I would ask people to be very, very thoughtful about jumping to conclusions about active cases or active investigations based on what they hear in the media, because the media never has all the information necessary to reach that conclusion. Above and beyond that, I would ask people to be very thoughtful about jumping to conclusions of their own based upon less than complete information. And I use the Frederick case as an example. People have jumped to conclusions or formulated their own beliefs about what happened without having an entire case file in front of them. They're never going to have all the information for a variety of reasons. But I think that if people are thoughtful about the impact of what they do on others, I think that it would make all the difference in the world. The last thing I would ask people to do is, and I mentioned this earlier in response to your question, the best thing that a secondary supporter can do is simply start by believing what a person says unless and until you are confronted with contrary, compelling information. Does that make sense?
That was very lawyer of you, but yes, it does.
No, but it's good.
What I really want to say, I mean, let's be honest. What I really want to say is quit being jerks.
Stop breaking the law, assholes.
quit trying to think that you on your couch behind an anonymous keyboard knows better than those of us who are professionals in the field who are always going to ascribe to us a motive to do something that is unethical, immoral, or illegal. We're doing our level best and quit trying to think that you know better than we do because you have some preconceived notion about law enforcement or prosecutors. That's what I really want people to do. Let us do our jobs.
It's fair. It's fair.
Use that if you want. That's what really grinds my gears.
And if you are that passionate about solving crimes, guess what? There are places you can volunteer. You can actually go just work in law enforcement if you want to give it a shot. I mean, you can try. Mm-hmm. So if you're that passionate about it, then follow that passion.
Right.
Then the criminal justice system needs you.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are prosecutors' offices all over this country who need attorneys.
Yep.
Who are short staffed and doing our level best to handle the crush of cases. Go to law school and get a degree and become a prosecutor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
you're not going to get paid a whole lot, but you can imagine you're going to be doing it for the right reasons.
Exactly. And that, I mean, that's what makes the difference, right? Like nobody gets into law enforcement work or any of these avenues because they want to make $1 million.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They do it because they have a passion. They want to help people. They want to solve crimes. And so if you feel that way, then go do it. Absolutely. So
have at it. Right.
I think that's good. I think that's a good wrap. And thank you, Honorable Michael Rourke, for joining us.
Oh, and his head's big enough.
Thanks, Kara.
Of course. Well, you're not going to thank your wife.
Thanks, honey.
Yeah, I'll see her later. I have to go check on the dinner I'm looking for.
What a guy.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.
I cannot give you legal advice.